Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there. Welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, with 3 weeks to go to the US election, why Latino voters could be paving a key way, proving a key, rather, in the race for the White House. Is there too much froth in the AI chip market? And we're looking at fake wine. After a major European police raid, we lift the lid on difficulties of policing the multi-billion dollar racket of fake wines.
That's one of the big things when it comes to wine fraud. How many people can genuinely authenticate the wine even when that bottle is open?
A heady taste of that brew later on in the show. First, though, global sovereign debt. That's the debt held by countries around the world. It's likely to exceed $100 trillion by the end of this year. That's according to the International Monetary Fund, which says that tougher action may be needed to stabilise borrowing in many major economies around the world. With me to discuss this today and the wider global debt problems since the COVID pandemic is Professor Ken Rogoff of Harvard University, himself a former chief economist at the IMF, of course. Ken, hello. This looks like a landmark number, I guess, $100 trillion. That's almost as much as global GDP itself. How concerned should we be?
Well, I think a lot more concerned than 5 or 10 years ago. And first and foremost, because interest rates are a lot higher. So government debt is continually being rolled over, refinanced. It's effectively, you know, at a variable interest rate. Well, interest rates had been historic lows, and now they're not. And so it means the service costs have gone way up. So it's definitely a bigger problem. The IMF also stressed that they think the true debt, the hidden debt, is much higher because a lot of countries find ways to hide debt in state-owned enterprises that's a little bit off the books. When they run into trouble, it comes slamming onto the books.
Indeed. I mean, we should spell this out. The biggest debtor countries around the world, of course, do remain the big industrial ones, the United States, China. They can afford, I guess, to be more heavily indebted, perhaps $16 trillion in the case of China. This is one estimate by the fund, I think. $35 trillion for the US. That's a big slice of the total, isn't it? That's half of it right there. They can afford that level of debt, not so much if you're perhaps one of those smaller nations.
Well, they can afford it, but I mean, they're both in different positions right now. The United States has a lot of inflationary pressures, and its debt is certainly, you know, out of control politically. So that could result in higher inflation. That's true in a lot of countries. So you can go to many middle income emerging markets that had been defaulting, you know, the Turkeys, the Indonesias. Well, Argentina is still in default, but many of them have been able to start borrowing in their own currency, and so they end up having inflation. For the poorer countries, and you know that we're talking about 80 or so of them, they're not able to do that, and almost all of them are in trouble. Some of the larger ones still can get into problems also, having to inflate, having macro chaos, and also possibly defaulting on private debt.
Okay. Let's hear from one of the more distressed countries at the lower end of the income scale you mentioned there. It's Ghana. Ghana defaulted on most of its $30 billion external debt during the pandemic crisis of a couple of years ago. Inflation spiraled at the time. The local currency collapsed, especially after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which affected energy prices, of course, and the country was forced into an emergency bailout. I've been speaking about the root causes that led Ghana to this crisis with Professor Godfred Bobkin. He's a professor of finance at the University of Ghana.
Ghana officially entered a high debt distress category from 2014, even though we had an IMF-supported program from April 3rd, 2015 to April 2019, that IMF-supported program could not restore debt sustainability. So we exited that IMF-supported program in 2019, still being categorized as at high risk of debt distress. Then we saw the financial sector cleanup costs also being absorbed by the public sector, then together with the energy sector indebtedness cost and all of that. Then from there, we moved straight into the effect of COVID, which also affected revenue. And then, of course, in the case of Ghana, we abused the COVID. Ghana actually overspent in the name of COVID, which was also an election year.
Basically, you're saying that Ghana has a habit of overspending in election years because politicians want to get re-elected, and they leave the country vulnerable when there's a crisis, an unexpected crisis, such as COVID-19.
Precisely. So we overspent to win over the electorate in an election year. And then again, we tend to abuse the fiscal space anytime we were confronted with crisis.
So it kind of spiraled out of control. I mean, this is one of the countries that everyone was talking about as one of the hopes for West Africa, wasn't it? It was the second largest economy after Nigeria. It was doing well. Now, this year, you finally emerged out of the latest default situation. I think the president has called it the turning of a corner. He said, we've accomplished what everyone said was impossible. Everything is looking up. Are you that optimistic about where Ghana is heading now that it's emerged from default?
Certainly not that quite. And I don't think that we could claim credit for this, actually, because we've taken investors through a very expensive debt restructuring, which has affected even pensioners and the vulnerable. You cannot jubilate over that, actually.
What's the answer?
I think the answer lies in deep governance reforms. We cannot get fiscal sustainability solely through debt restructuring. How often can you do that?
That's the view of Professor Godfred Bobkin in a sub-Saharan destination, of course. What of the bigger countries, though, named in the IMF's report? The IMF said that several of them, such as the UK, France, Italy, Brazil and South Africa, have reached debt levels where tackling the problems they face will require steep cuts in spending and tax rises. I'm joined now by Monica de Bolla. She's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. She's an expert on Brazil's economy. Hi there, Monica. Just first of all, I mean, do you agree with the IMF's analysis that Brazil is walking into some trouble here with its debt levels?
Hello, and thank you for having me. So I do and I don't. Let me explain that. So I do agree with the fund, obviously, that, you know, debt problems or debt levels are at a very problematic level, obviously. And of course, for some countries, you know, those debt levels are high, and a few countries are better able to deal with that than others. But nonetheless, it is certainly the case that in Brazil, the debt to GDP ratio is high.
90% of gross domestic product, right? 90% roughly at the moment, well above the regional average.
Yes. Gross debt is roughly 90% of GDP, which puts Brazil in the category of one of the most indebted middle-income countries in the world.
President Lula's just overspending. That's what some will say, certainly his political opponents.
Yeah, they will most definitely say that. However, if we look at, you know, the trajectory of debt to GDP in Brazil, and if we look at past, you know, results for debt to GDP over past years, we will see that, you know, the overall debt to GDP ratio in Brazil has always sustained itself at those high levels. Mm. So it's not as if there's been a substantial increase in debt to GDP under Lula, and it's very obvious from the number. No, you cannot see that. So in essence, you know, Brazil's had a spending problem for a very long time. It's not new, and it's not under this government, but under many other governments of the past. And that's why the debt to GDP ratio or the debt level in Brazil is so high.
Okay. I want to bring in Ken Rogoff again on that. I mean, do you agree with that assessment? Or is this kind of about fecklessness by governments, or do you think it's just bad luck because of the pandemic and other things that have caught governments unawares?
Well, I think the pandemic certainly, you know, put debt up everywhere and people had to do it. I think what Monica Dibola said about Brazil, they've been there a long time. Actually, it came down somewhat during the pandemic because their inflation was so high. It was a sort of like a partial default. Now it's back up. I think a problem Lula has is that he was in government last time, and it was the commodity boom of all time. China was growing, and he did a solid job, but maybe not as great as he thinks. This time, that commodity boom is not happening. China is not growing. I think their downside risk to global growth is solid, but still. So it's not as easy to manage. And I'd also say, as I said at the outset, we have higher real interest rates now. That's a material change. I mean, Brazil's always had high interest rates, but they're even higher now.
Okay, a quick question to you both then. Should this be more of a public conversation? I mean, economics has become very polarized, like everything, I suppose, these days. There are those who say industrial policies are needed, you know, we need to spend, Keynesianism and all of that. Countries need to invest to grow. But then there are others who say we can't go on going like this, and this debt levels are just getting out of hand. A quick thought, Ken?
Well, investing to grow is great, but how much of this money is really investing to grow? I think the IMF rightly says there probably need to be some adjustments, as you say, in higher taxes, lower spending in many countries, not every country, but many countries.
And Monica?
Well, frankly, I think the focus of the question should be, you know, really, what are we doing and where are we going? Because we have a climate issue to resolve, and that's putting it mildly. And that is definitely going to necessitate spending by governments. So debt is going to increase in different parts of the world in the process of climate adaptation. Okay. And so countries should really be in the business of creating fiscal space so that they can do the necessary spending for climate adaptation. And that isn't happening. And so my concern is really placed square on that particular question.
Professor Monica Dibola, thank you very much indeed. And Ken Rogoff in Harvard, thank you both.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Now, a quick look at the markets with Christina Hooper. She's the Chief Global Market Strategist at Invesco's. Earnings season began this week, Christina.
Yes, it did.
And what are you looking at?
So it's great to be with you. What I'm looking at, several different things. Of course, we want to see that earnings beat expectations. And that is a fairly easy task for most companies, because what we saw over the course of the quarter was that estimates were downwardly revised. And this is actually a pattern that we've seen for some time now. So it becomes easier for companies in general to then come in and beat expectations. So that's certainly important. But I find what's more important is the kind of anecdotal information we get from the calls, in terms of, for example, the company's sense of the consumer, the health of the consumer, or, you know, other observations that they've made that give us a sense of the macro environment.
Which sectors are looking strongest right now, briefly?
So financials are, you know, the ones that have most, you know, so many have reported. So they are an outsized portion of the companies that have reported thus far, and they've done quite well in general. What we've seen is investment banking has been profitable. M&A activity has picked up. Okay. We've certainly seen financials benefit from stock trading. What's really interesting, though, is the
we're going to have to leave it there. Sorry, Christina. I'm sorry. We have to get on to our next guest, but thank you very much for your time. One of the areas that Christina is talking about where we have been seeing results, of course, has been in the area of the chip market. European shares posted their biggest one-day drop in over 2 weeks on Tuesday, weighed above all by technology stocks. The chip equipment maker ASML's latest results were leaked to the markets. They showed a disappointing annual sales forecast. More broadly, though, the chip industry is experiencing strangely uneven times, it seems. To discuss this, who better to ask than Dan Ives? He's the Managing Director at the Senior Equity Analyst Wedbush Securities. Hi, Dan. In California, this is a complicated time for the tech sector, it seems, specifically in chip making. I mean, what's been going on in California specifically with the AI chips, those like NVIDIA and so on?
Yeah, I mean, look, you're either part of the AI party or you're not. If you look what happened here with ASML, I mean, they're really seeing more issues on the memory side, almost some of the legacy chip players. If you look where the strength is, it's godfather of AI, Jensen, NVIDIA, AI chips, AMD. And that's right. Why you're really seeing almost two separate markets playing out in terms of chips.
Right. So it's very complicated. And I guess the market's trying to figure out where the profit truly lies. But the chip makers have struggled. I mean, specifically with these latest reports we've been getting that President Joe Biden might be capping exports of advanced AI chips to some countries around the world.
Yeah, I think that's the bar's going to be worse than the bite. I mean, the headline sounds scary. I'd be surprised if they actually do that or in a way that significantly impacts demand. We've seen this the last year and a half. We're going to go through these sort of, you know, shots across the bow moments. The reality is this AI revolution is just in the early days of playing out. It's still 9:30 p.m. in a party that goes to 4 a.m. And I think it's what sends tech stocks higher, not just into year, and we think 20% into next year, despite this sell-off we saw in chip stocks, which I kind of view as just noise.
So you're seeing then a continuing consolidation of power effectively with these, the major players, the ones really pushing the envelope at the top end of the AI sector, like NVIDIA and some of the other big names.
Exactly. Look, I think the strong get stronger. And that's what that we'll see in NVIDIA, AMD. Now, look, if you looked up disaster, St. Elmo's, whatever, call it Nightmare on Elm Street, you'd see Intel's ticker.
Yes.
So the point is not everyone's benefiting, but that's why at the top of that mountain, it's godfather of AI, Jensen, NVIDIA, in his black leather jacket.
Absolutely. That is Dan Ives putting it in a nutshell for you. He's Managing Director, Senior Equity Analyst at Wedbush Securities. Intel Corp, by the way, cutting expenses in a restructuring that includes delays to planned factories in Germany and Poland. That's the latest news from them. Now, yesterday, Kamala Harris was racing around Pennsylvania as part of her presidential campaign. Today, she's moved on to Georgia in her push for the White House. It seems she is making a concerted effort to court Black and Latino voters there, despite holding a clear lead among both groups. Democrats have warned that she needs to do more to energize these voters to turn out for her in November. It could prove crucial in a race that looks set to be decided by very thin margins. So what is fueling the Latino vote? Alan Tiscareno has been to El Paso in Texas, which sits on the U.S.-Mexico border. He spoke to Paola Marquez, who works at the university there.
My first election was just for fun because I wanted a first woman president. And then the second one, it turned into actual rights that were taken away from me. And now I'm actually scared to have more rights taken away. So this election has become very important for me to vote.
Paola lives with her sister in a family-owned home. She has tried to move out with her boyfriend. However, rising rent and grocery prices have made this difficult.
With groceries and gas, that's where I've been seeing the biggest increases. This is a luxury, and I know a lot of people cannot afford. We have a Costco membership, and we only put gas at Costco. But at the same time, it's affecting because there's only one Costco in El Paso, and it's kind of in the middle of El Paso, and we live far away. So we waste more gas driving to the gas station just so we can get cheaper gas compared to the gas stations near my house.
Adam Regalado is a 20-year-old senior, a first-time voter. On the policies of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, Adam finds Trump economic policies appealing.
I can get behind some of his, like, economy stuff, I'm not gonna lie. With Harris, I think, personally, I am a gay man, and a lot of her, like, social policies when it relates to the LGBTQ plus community, when it relates to health and reproductive rights, her stance on everything is something that I completely agree with and something that I want to continue seeing moving forward, and we still have a lot of work to do, and it seems like she wants to make those things happen.
Alan Tisgrain is speaking to Latino voters, I should say, in Texas. For more on the role that they may play, I've been speaking to our Washington correspondent, Bernd de Busman. How important did he think that the Latino vote could prove to be in the election?
Well, I think they'll play a huge role in the election, in particular some of these swing states in the western part of the country. In Arizona, for example, it's about 1 in 4 voters. In Nevada, it's about 1 in 5. And, you know, these are massive electorates. And in the case of Nevada, for example, many of them are still undecided. So I don't think it's kind of downplaying it at all to say that they could ultimately decide the election in some of these swing states. Even on the East Coast, where they're less of a percentage of the state population, it's still enough that if it's a very narrow election, even a small shift of the needle among Latino voters in one direction or the other could ultimately decide these swing states and by extension, the election.
Is it true to say that Latinos, particularly more recent immigrants, have traditionally been associated with the Democrat side, but maybe now have become or seem to be becoming a little bit more conservative, more mixed in terms of their allegiance?
They have traditionally been more aligned to the Democrats, and that's something that goes back many decades, all the way to President Kennedy, who was the first president to kind of really go after them as an electorate bloc. But in recent elections, you've seen the lead the Democrats have among Latino voters kind of shrinking every election from 2016 to 2020 to now. And while a majority of Latinos are still likely to vote for the Democrats, we're seeing that gap narrow slowly but surely over time. And, you know, recent polls suggest that Donald Trump is performing better among Latino voters than any Republican has in many, many decades. So it's certainly a slow change, but we are seeing a change.
What is the Republican message that's chiming with them?
Well, the thing about Latino voters, which is similar to the wider electorate, is that more than anything, they're concerned about the economy. When I go out and speak to Latino voters, the economy comes up first, and of the various sub-issues there, inflation comes up first. So when they hear Donald Trump vowing to end inflation or help them in their day-to-day pocketbook issues, that really strikes a chord with a lot of Latinos. That and also his vows to kind of build a stronger border and, you know, kind of force more people to go through legal pathways, which, you know, many second or third generation Latinos feel very strongly about in this country. That's a secondary issue, but definitely economics is the first.
So they would prefer tougher immigration rules because they followed the rules themselves?
Many would, and many of these Latino communities in places like South Texas, for example, where some of the cities are 95% plus Latino, they're the ones most directly impacted by rising or falling number of migrant detention at the border, because it's their communities that are there, you know, very much overlooking Mexico, you know, actually jutting the border. In places like that, many of them, they're not saying they don't want immigrants. They just want more immigrants to come through legal pathways as their parents or perhaps their grandparents did in the past.
And these votes, I suppose, are so close. It may just take a few thousand one way or another to determine the outcome of a state.
Certainly in Nevada, for example, in the last election, the Democrats won by 33,000 votes, which, you know, that's not a particularly large amount. So if the Republicans continue gaining in some of these key battleground states among this electorate, it really could make the difference, especially if things are looking very, very tight nationally and very, very tight in some of these battleground states with large Latino populations, Nevada, Arizona, for example.
The BBC's Bernd de Busman. Now, we hear a lot about online fraud and counterfeit accounts, don't we? But there are still plenty of real-life areas where knowing what's genuine from what isn't also matters a great deal. One of these is wine. French police say that they've just broken up an international fraud ring that was passing poor quality wine off as bottles of the most expensive vintage stuff. They've arrested six people, accusing them of fabricating labels representing famous French vineyards, this to sell bottles for over $15,000 each. I've been speaking to Rebecca Gibb about it all. She's the author of Vintage Crime, A Short History of Wine Fraud.
You hear about these stories almost on a weekly basis. Of course, this particular one, where the value of the wines was so high, really attracts our attention. There are cases of wine fraud in much smaller amounts with much less illustrious wines happening all the time. I mean, wine fraud has been, it's as old as wine itself.
You, of course, are not a wine detective as such, are you? But how do they operate? I can imagine somebody with a very kind of a sharp nose sniffing themselves around cellars, trying to spot the fakes. Or is it rather more, I don't know, forensic than that?
There are such things as wine detectives today, and they use some rudimentary techniques, like such with flashlights, jeweler's loops, that you're just basically using their eyes and knowing, having a really in-depth knowledge of, you know, vintages that couldn't be made or vineyards that weren't yet producing in those times or the fonts wrong, that sort of example. I mean, when it gets really, really serious, they can go into like radioactive and like carbon dirting bottles and stuff. But ultimately, if you want to find out whether a wine is fake or not, you actually have to open the bottle. And that somewhat defeats the purpose.
It does, yeah. Because once you've opened it, that's 15,000 euros down the drain. Well, not down the drain, down your throat, hopefully. But it will obviously no longer be resaleable.
Well, you say that, but often in many of these cases, actually genuine bottles that have been emptied have then been refilled and recorked. So that's why it's very important to some of the most fine wine domains in the world that they ensure that those bottles are smashed after they have been consumed so that they're not refilled.
There is the issue of provenance, isn't there? A bit like an old master painting. If you were trying to track down whether that was real or not, you would follow the paper trail showing where it had been bought from and that. I mean, that would also apply to wines, right?
Absolutely. Wines with perfect provenance, e.g. they are purchased directly from the cellar where it was produced, do attract a premium. When it comes to wine and much like art, we are relying on an expert's opinion to verify whether that artwork or whether that bottle is genuine. And unfortunately, humans are not actually always correct.
Wine fraud expert Rebecca Gibb. And that's it for this edition of World Business Report. Cheers.
The race to become the next president of the United States is on.
We can't drop the pace now.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Count on the BBC World Service to keep you informed on the latest breaking news with insight and analysis you can trust.
Immigration, if you look at polls, a top concern for so many U.S. voters.
The issue of the economy reigns supreme for everybody.
For a global perspective on the U.S. election, search for The Global Story, the documentary, and The Global News Podcast, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.